From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Everything related to pedophilia is hard to talk about. Sexual attraction to children has to be the most pronounced taboo in modern culture, and it seems almost impossible to separate the condition itself from the crime that often comes from it. Dr. Fred Berlin studies sexual disorders at Johns Hopkins. He says we've so demonized pedophiles that we tend not to see them as human beings. And while he understands that kind of thinking, he says it doesn't help. Berlin argues that if we just think of pedophilia as a criminal mindset rather than what it really is, a mental disorder, we limit our ability to deal with it, even control it. Today in the program, Dr. Berlin is with us to talk about pedophilia, to explain what it really is, what causes it, and what you do about it. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The case of former Penn State football coach Jerry Sandusky, who's been charged with sexually abusing 10 boys, is just the latest story that raises questions about pedophilia. The crime associated with pedophilia is so repugnant that it makes it difficult to separate it from the condition itself. The fact is, everything about this is hard to talk about. Dr. Fred Berlin has written that pedophilia challenges society to figure out how to demand proper moral conduct of the person afflicted with it, but it also challenges us to ask how we're going to demand proper moral conduct for ourselves as well. Dr. Berlin points out pedophilia is a mental disorder, and it's treatable, but he says if we just think about it as a criminal mindset, it keeps us from comprehending it and even controlling it. Today in the program, Dr. Berlin is with us to help understand the nature of pedophilia, what it is, what causes it, how you treat it. Dr. Fred Berlin is an associate professor of psychology at Johns Hopkins University. He's also the founder and director of the Johns Hopkins Sexual Disorders Clinic. He's joining us today from a studio at the Baltimore Sun in Baltimore, Maryland. And Dr. Berlin, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
For having me. I appreciate that.
I want to begin by asking you how we're supposed to talk about pedophilia, because, of course, it's an incredibly sensitive topic. And I guess the question is, how do you have a conversation about it without, you know, being accused of softening the impact or the severity of the of course, very serious crime that often results from the condition? How are we supposed to talk about this?
Well, certainly the emotional part of pedophilia is completely understandable. We're talking about children being victimized, crime, sex, but it's not going to solve the problem by people simply getting upset and leaving it at that. We really need to be able to think it through, and it's terribly important to be able to do research to find out more about the cause. It's terribly important to try, in that context, to prevent it from happening in the first place. The best favor we can do any potential victim is to keep he or she from becoming victimized in the first place, and we can only do that by learning more about what motivates individuals to engage in these behaviors, about the disorders that predispose them, how to prevent them, and how to successfully treat them.
You point out that the word pedophilia it's a diagnostic term, but it's taken on a different meaning in the, as you put it, the collective consciousness of society. How do we think about pedophiles?
Well, a psychiatric diagnosis is simply meant to be a shorthand way of conveying information. And so when a physician such as myself uses the word pedophilia, we're simply trying to indicate that a person's sexual orientation is directed either in whole or in part towards prepubescent children. It's not because they want to be that way. They're afflicted with this aberration in sexual makeup. Those terms, these diagnostic terms, are not meant to be used simply to put people down, to demonize them. And yet, as you mentioned a moment ago, in the collective consciousness of society, when the word pedophilia is used, or the word sexual predator, which is often thrown about rather loosely, we don't think of these as individuals who may be afflicted, who are struggling, who have families that care about them, who may have themselves a sense of wanting to be under better control. And I think to the extent that it drives the problem underground, it may do more harm than good.
Do you think that people who use that kind of language or think of it in that way, do you think you understand that mindset, that this is such a taboo that it leads to this kind of thinking?
Well, I think people are afraid that they don't understand. Clearly, we all want to protect children and keep others from being victimized. None of us differ about those important goals. The real question is, how can we most effectively achieve those goals? And if all that we do with someone who has pedophilia, who's sexually attracted to children, is send them to prison, there's nothing about prison alone that either erases those attractions or increases their ability to successfully resist acting on them. And like it or not, sooner or later, most of these people are back out in the community. So clearly, as with alcoholism, we need a firm and strong criminal justice component. We can't allow people without consequence to be driving drunk. But if the only thing we did for alcoholism was put people in a registry and punish them, we'd be nowhere near solving the problem in an effective fashion. I think that's a good analogy for what we're dealing with here. No responsible adult is going to suggest that if people engage in criminal behavior that they shouldn't be held accountable. But we do need to understand what's driving them. As with alcoholism, if there's a condition that needs to be treated in order to make them safer citizens within the community, then that's something we have to acknowledge and proceed to address.
Hmm. We're going to work through the scientific and the medical questions as we go along. But let me raise the moral questions that come with this. You've sort of been talking about the way we perceive all of this. You say that there are a number of conditions we used to see as, you know, as moral lapses. Obesity used to be related to gluttony. You've written about how clinical depression, or I suppose even chronic fatigue, was seen as, you know, laziness. And now we think differently about those conditions. But it seems like pedophilia is one of these things we just can't get past in that way. We can't really go beyond seeing it in some ways as a moral lapse, I guess.
Well, what we have to be careful to do is to appreciate two sides of the coin when we're talking about morality. For example, there are many people that seem to think that psychiatrists are just excusing sin by relabeling it psychopathology, and we have to be very careful not to do that. There are people of sound mind who misbehave, and they shouldn't be absolved of responsibility by saying that they're mentally ill. But the other side of that coin, which people often don't stop to think about, is that there are people who are predisposed to engage in certain forms of behavior because there is something fundamentally different or abnormal about their sexual makeup. They have a legitimate psychiatric condition, and to treat those people as though they were simply of sound mind and misbehaving, in my judgment, would be to miss an important point.
Critical question as we talk about the nature of pedophilia is how much of this is about character and conscience, as you've written, and how much of this is about sexual orientation or sexual makeup?
It's really much more, when we're talking about pedophilia, about sexual makeup. And let me explain it in a couple of ways. First, I'd make the point that if a person with conventional heterosexual interests is alone, a man fantasizing in a way that causes him to get aroused, he's fantasizing about a woman. If a person with pedophilia is alone and fantasizing in a way that causes him to become aroused, he's fantasizing about a little child. That's not about character. That's not about temperament. It's not about power and control or lacking social skills. It's about a fundamental aberration in sexual makeup. Again, if you ask me what the typical person with pedophilia is like, it's like asking me what the typical person with a heterosexual makeup is like. What people who are heterosexual share in common is that they're attracted to adults of the opposite gender. But any given individual who's heterosexual may be kind or cruel, caring or not caring, introverted or extroverted, intelligent or not quite so intelligent. And the same is absolutely true of pedophilia. So the notion that everybody with pedophilia, everyone who is struggling with these kinds of sexual feelings that most of us never experience, is inevitably characterologically flawed, that simply isn't correct.
You referenced this idea about power and control. And you often hear that this kind of behavior described that way. You say it's not about power. It's not about control.
Well, I'm talking about in terms of motivation. In other words, there's obviously a power disparity between an adult and the child. The question here is, what is motivating the behavior? It's not that someone's just trying to push a child around. We can get children to do lots of things. But the motivator for people with pedophilia is that they are experiencing strong sexual urges about prepubescent children in a way that the rest of us don't, and therefore they're coping in life from a very different perspective. Now, clearly, we can't allow them to act on that, but if we can learn more about how they became that way in the first place, if we can learn about interventions that will facilitate their ability to be in full control of themselves, that's a win-win situation. It's a win situation for them, and it's a win situation for society in general.
What do we know about the causes of pedophilia? I guess it sort of brings us to the nature-nurture argument. Let me ask a very basic question. Are you born with pedophilia?
Well, if I may, and I won't avoid your question, but let me answer it slightly differently by starting with what it's not due to, because I think it's terribly important to understand that, and then I'll get to the nature or nurture.
Sure.
But the first point I want to make is that pedophilia is not present because of a voluntary choice. In other words, none of us as little children sat down and thought about it and said to ourselves, look, when I grow up, do I want to grow up to be attracted to women or to men or to boys or to girls? None of us think about it or reflect on our options and decide. In growing up, we discover who it is we're attracted to. And in my case, in growing up, discovering that I'm attracted to women has made my life a lot easier. I've talked to many men who, for example, are attracted exclusively to prepubescent boys. And nobody in their right mind, if they had the choice, which we do not, would decide to grow up to have that kind of sexual attraction. These folks in growing up discover they're afflicted with this aberration, and I think we'd all agree it's not an affliction that we would wish upon even those that we don't particularly care about. So the first point I want to make is that people discover that they have this difference in sexual makeup. They've not somehow simply chosen to experience an alternative state of mind. Now, having argued it's not my fault that I have pedophilia, it is my responsibility to do something about it. But as with drug addiction and alcoholism, doing something about it may require gaining access to appropriate mental health care. So that's what pedophilia is not due to. We then look at nature and nurture on the nurture side, the life experience side. It is the case that many people with pedophilia, and we're talking mostly about men here, are former victims grown older. Why, thank God, many boys who are victimized aren't damaged in that way, we'd like to learn more about. But the fact that some weren't damaged as a result of their early abuse doesn't constitute evidence that others weren't indeed so damaged. So One of the tragedies often in looking at an adult with pedophilia is we are looking at a former victim grown older. The other side that you asked about was the nature side. And none of us, of course, decide to have sex because we read a book and think it's a good idea. Sexual feelings well up inside of us because of our biology, our brain chemistry, our hormones, and so on. And there's a lot of interesting research now that is beginning to suggest that at least in some cases, some people may be experiencing abnormal or different sorts of sexual cravings, for example, cravings for children, because something's gone wrong at the level of biology in terms of chromosomes, hormones, and so on. But in terms of where we are as a society and how to treat these individuals, I still believe that the most important point for us to appreciate is that these are people who've discovered that they have this aberration in their mental makeup and their sexual makeup. They're not simply people who, because they're bad people, have somehow chosen to be different. Mm.
There's some documentation you've said that suggests that it could be in some ways the result of a traumatic brain injury, the result of tumors also. It seems like there's another – it's a pretty complicated sort of equation here that's going on.
Yes, and I don't want to suggest that it's the same cause for everybody.
Right.
Lung cancer, often it's caused by cigarette smoking, but there can be other factors that sometimes play a role. But there have been some cases, dramatic cases, of people who've developed pedophilia in the context of a brain tumor. There was even one dramatic case where after the tumor was removed, the pedophilic urges disappeared.
Yeah.
Although we don't talk about it much, when people develop Alzheimer's, they can, in some cases, simply become disinhibited sexually, but some of them actually develop different sorts of sexual interests as a result of that brain disease than what they've had previously. So again, perhaps we shouldn't be so surprised if we get into the scientific arena that some of these problems may be rooted to understandings that will come out of further scientific research. If we simply label these folks and say they're bad and want to throw them away, it doesn't necessarily enable us to do the kind of research that might lead to these important sorts of answers.
Do you think that's been part of the problem? These kinds of labels are limiting the amount of research that is being done, or people inclined to want to do such research.
I think part of the problem is that we don't see these as people who are deserving of care. Yeah. You know, we forget now that years ago, if you had an alcoholic problem, you were a bum in the gutter.
Right.
If you were a woman with a drinking problem, we said even worse things about you. Now we have the Betty Ford Clinic. We don't want people getting in cars and killing people while driving drunk. But we also recognize that good people can be struggling with these kinds of cravings and that many of them are indeed deserving of help. We know Aunt Jane or Uncle Harry has the drinking problem, and so they're human beings. Today in contemporary society, when we use the word pedophilia, we don't get the sense that it's Uncle Harry or somebody that we would care about. We see them as less than human. And if I may, just to finish up on that thought, sure. One of the sad things right now is that as I'm speaking, there are large numbers of 17, 18-year-old individuals who are privately aware of the fact that they are not attracted to people their own age, that they're attracted to much younger, 6, 7, 8-year-old children. And because of the way in which we've demonized this, the last thing that they're going to do is raise their hand and come in for help. In a society, we don't encourage them to. Almost any other mental health problem, we hear ads, if you're having problems in this way, for God's sakes, come in. Why are we not encouraging people to come in before the fact to get the necessary treatment rather than just having to pick up the pieces after all the damage has occurred?
Dr. Fred Berlin is with us. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Sexual Disorders Clinic. And we need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about pedophilia. No behavior so reviled in American society than when an adult sexually abuses a child. But what exactly do we understand about the condition that leads to that crime? Our guest today is Fred Berlin. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins University. He's talking to us about the nature of pedophilia, pointing out that if we just think about it as a criminal mindset, it keeps us from comprehending it and even controlling it. Let's go to the phones. Heidi is with us in Salt Lake City. Heidi, welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
I appreciate your program. It's a very important topic. And even though I used to work for the Attorney General Child Abuse Unit, I am not speaking for them. I just wanted to make that clear. But what I did learn from my time there is that most of the criminals in our prison system have been abused themselves, and they become the next generation of abusers if they are not helped as children. So if we're truly caring about prevention, these people with these aberrant desires beyond just sexuality, it is they must be prevented from abusing again, because there is no abuse that's more damaging to an individual throughout their life than to be abused as a child. So I'm wondering if there has been any progress. There wasn't any when I was dealing with the topic. It was the idea was just keep them away from children. They should be totally, you know, just not available to any youth population, because those are the people that need the help the most are the children, so that we don't keep going through this cycle. It's a learned behavior. It's not something they're born with.
Yeah. Well, let me ask, Dr. Berlin, you referred to this earlier a bit. Are sexually abused children more disposed to develop pedophilia? I mean, you say it constitutes one known risk factor, but how do we understand that?
Yes. Well, obviously, when children are abused, whether it's physically, emotionally, or sexually, there can be serious consequences. Certainly, when boys are abused sexually, particularly if it's been at an early age and over a sustained period of time, that is a risk factor that can warp their subsequent sexual development and can predispose pedophilia. Many girls who've been sexually abused, unfortunately, don't usually get pedophilia, which is good news, but many of them end up in prostitution. They end up not knowing how to manage their sexual needs in a healthy and proper fashion. So the need to try to identify children who have been abused, to intervene early, to try to be helpful, is extremely important. And although I think there's still much more that needs to be done in that direction. A great deal more attention, in my judgment, is being paid to that matter now than had been several years ago. The other important point, and I want to say this delicately, because we never want to in any way whatsoever be insensitive to the ways in which children have been harmed, but there can be a spectrum. In other words, some children who've been abused are tremendously damaged by that. Others, something terribly wrong has happened to them, but for reasons we sometimes don't fully understand, they're terribly resilient and turn out to do pretty well in their lives. And so the message I wanted to get across is that sometimes we as adults, in meaning well, seem to give the message to every abused child, particularly a sexually abused child, that they've been ruined for life, that they've in effect been given a life sentence. So I think that's the wrong message to give. I think we have to acknowledge something terribly wrong has happened. We have to help them understand it wasn't their fault. We have to look at what problems it's causing them. But the goal is to try to make sure that they don't, in effect, have a life sentence, that they can transcend that and go on to be productive and responsible citizens. And certainly in many cases, that indeed can be accomplished. Mm.
Heidi, glad you called. Thanks very much. And by the way, Heidi, I should mention we're going to be dealing with the particular questions of treatment as we go along. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Back to the phones. Ricky is with us in Salt Lake. Ricky, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
My question is, you know, we seem to be here talking about people who are pedophiliacs that, you know, sort of from early age, and they're just focused on children and so on and so forth. But my experience is there's a lot of people out there that are married, have wife and children, and then, you know, attack their own children or other children. And that does not appear to be the type of definition that you're using. What about those people that just simply do it to kids when they don't really have a total focus on children?
That's a good question.
Let me make a couple of points, and it's a very good question. First of all, just as not every drunk driver is an alcoholic, not every adult who becomes involved sexually with a child has pedophilia. Sometimes people have serious drug or alcohol problems that disinhibits them, impairs their judgment. It predisposes them to act in sexual ways that are improper and even illegal. And I could go on down the list. Yeah. But it's also important to understand that there are some people with pedophilia who are not exclusively attracted to children. They have some degree of attraction to adults. But the fact that they're attracted to adults doesn't erase the fact that they're still much more strongly attracted sexually to kids than are the rest of us. And it's very important not to miss that point, because it reminds us that just because somebody is in a relationship with an adult doesn't mean that that necessarily guarantees that they wouldn't be someone who, in addition to that, may be strongly drawn towards children. And as the caller, Ricky, said, there are many individuals who do repeatedly get involved with children, even though they have had adult relationships. And these are sometimes people with what we call the non-exclusive form of a pedophilic disorder. They're capable of having sex with adults, but the fact that they're capable of doing that doesn't erase the fact that they still have recurrent sexual urges towards children, very different from the way from what is true for most of the rest of us.
Ricky, thanks very much for the call. So Dr. Berlin, when a man, and it's usually a man, 90%, I guess, who are pedophiles, when a person, a man, acts on those sexual urges that he feels, when he abuses a child, for example, what has happened? I suppose you could say that they've acted on a sexual instinct. But do we think about the person who has acted on that urge any differently than the person who has the urge? When they act on it, is there a different gradation? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, there can be the same spectrum that we see amongst people who have adult attractions. In other words, we see some people who are having adult attractions, but their drive isn't terribly high. They don't have a great deal of difficulty in resisting temptations. They find it fairly easy to conform their behaviors to the dictates of conscience. And yet we see other people, and I guess that's why we've heard terms like sexual addiction, who just seem to be so driven, not because they're qualitatively different in their sex, not because they're attracted to kids, but because they just seem to have such a strong drive that they're not able to control it. So when it comes to pedophilia, we see some people that, they just seem to have very strong drive. They're recurrently having lusts for children. There's other people where the spectrum of their attraction is broader in the sense that that they not only are drawn sexually towards children, but they actually do, and this is going to sound paradoxical, enjoy the companionship, that they feel affection and so on. And sometimes in working with victims, it's been necessary to point out to them that, yes, they were indeed betrayed by this individual becoming sexual with you, but you can at least comfort them that not every other good deed that was done for them by the adult was simply pretending to care. The problem is often that these people do care. It's simply that they're caring in a very unacceptable and wrong way. The child has to understand that that was not their fault, that it is unacceptable, and those involved in treatment have to try to educate these folks about the appropriate way to deal with their needs for a sex and affection and intimacy.
Well, you write about the fact that there's a kind of a cognitive impairment going on here. One particular research that you mentioned in one of the papers you've written, Dr. John Money, has suggested, in fact, there's rarely a malicious disregard for the well-being of children.
Yes, and again, I want to underline, and we all know this, that in no way whatsoever means the behavior is acceptable.
Of course.
We all agree that the right. Children need to be protected. But again, if we're trying to understand the motives and the problems presented by those who experience these attractions, it is often the case that when an individual experiences strong urges, you see this in drug addiction, alcoholism, even something as simple as cigarettes, that those urges often distort their perceptions and they can't look as objectively at their own actions as the way the rest of us do. I'm a physician. I've seen a case of an individual who had a very serious condition that was causing him to lose fingers and that was going to be made worse by cigarette smoking, and yet between two remaining fingers on one of his hands, he still had a cigarette, really engaging in all sorts of self-deceptive thought process where he just couldn't see or fully appreciate the damage he was doing. And that's, again, one of the tragedies that we often see here, that these aren't, in many cases, like the sociopath who knows he's hurting someone else and doesn't care. Metaphorically speaking, it's much more often like the blind man who simply doesn't see. Now, again, I want to repeatedly underline that in no way excuses the behavior, but it does give us a little bit different sense of the individual as someone who needs to be helped to see things more objectively, as we often do with drug addiction and alcoholism, rather than someone who's simply morally corrupt to the core.
Let's go back to the phones. David is with us in Midvale, Utah. David, welcome.
Thank you. The way that I've been hearing you describe their sexuality almost sounds the way I do as describing mine as a homosexual. And I wonder, would you describe these guys as, you know, that's their sexual orientation, or maybe because you mentioned that they can actually have romantic relationships with adults, is it perhaps a manifestation of their broader sexuality, or is it their actual orientation?
I think that it is fair to talk about it as an orientation, and the sad part, of course, is that for very good reasons, we as a society cannot allow them to act on that orientation because, you know, children are not just miniature adults. They don't have the maturity to truly make a decision about becoming involved in these kinds of very powerful emotional relationships. But yes, it is just another form of orientation. I guess we all have to get into our own values. I think many of us believe that if it comes to the behaviors of consenting adults in the privacy of the bedroom, that we don't necessarily want government in the bedroom making decisions. On the other hand, we do have a right to protect children. And so I can feel for the person who, through no fault of his own, has an orientation that's directed towards children. At the same time, though, I still have to give priority to protecting youngsters and to figuring out ways to help these people so that if they are going to be free in society, they can be free as safe and productive citizens.
David, glad you called. I wonder, Dr. Berlin, do you think you understand, or how do you explain, I guess, maybe the better way to put it, how do you explain what seems to be the tendency of, at least at one point, a significant number of priests, for example, who abused children? I mean, how do you explain that? Are pedophiles, for example, drawn to certain, you know, avocations or things?
Well, some are. But again, I want to be cautious here because for understandable reasons, we were so much focused on what priests had done. I mean, not only is that an abuse of trust, but if I can put it this way, it's an abuse of sacred trust. So and also because many of these priests have taken a vow of celibacy, and are expected to live a moral life. All of those factors, I think, led us correctly to pay a lot of attention to what was happening and try to rectify that issue. But the fact of the matter is that there's no evidence that the percentage of priests who have pedophilia or who are involved with children is any higher than what we see in the general population. We've seen these same problems in Big Brothers and Boy Scouts of America, organizations of those sorts. Now, again, there may be some people who get into those organizations because they are looking for opportunities to be involved with children. Others really do, as I said earlier, enjoy children, want to be around them, want to do good for them, and don't realize the extent to which their own sexual predilections are going to turn what otherwise might have been a very healthy and positive experience into something that can then become so negative.
I wanted to ask you, when we're talking about a person's responsibility for their actions, you put it this way, it's not a person's fault that he has pedophilia, but it is his responsibility to do something about it. And I wonder, are people with pedophilia, are they, without being mandated to do this, are they seeking out treatment? You said before, a lot of them feel so demonized that it's difficult to come forward. But do people seek treatment?
Yes, but I don't want to oversimplify it. Anytime we're talking about a large group of people, there are going to be differences in terms of how responsible various members of that group may be. But certainly there are significant numbers. I don't want to be more precise than I'm capable of being, but significant numbers of individuals who are attracted to children, who want treatment, who appreciate treatment, who do well in treatment. There's also been anonymous surveys done asking people, and it's done anonymously because they're terrified about identifying themselves, but asking them if they could come in without being identified, would they be interested in treatment? And significant numbers have indicated that they would be. Now, again, there are some problems in people even coming to a physician such as myself, because if somebody comes in and I have reason to suspect that they may have at some point in their life abused a child, I'm going to have to report them to criminal justice authorities.
Right.
And most people who want help want just that. They don't want to necessarily put themselves in a position where they might be worried about going to prison for many years rather than getting the assistance that they had hoped for.
You have pointed out also that some 90% of people with pedophilia who had treatment mandated, after they had sort of served out that mandated portion, they stayed with it, and often at their own expense.
Yes, that's correct. I mentioned earlier, and we talked about it, how these people will sometimes, because of their urges before treatment, not be looking as objectively as we would have liked at their own actions. But when we get them in treatment, when we confront them, when we insist that they begin to stop kidding themselves, that they need to really understand the true implications of their actions, large numbers of them then begin to see the light, if I can put it that way, and even on their own will continue in treatment. And so I have a program that I've run for over 25 years where lots of people over the years came in as a condition of either parole or probation. But the overwhelming majority of them, even when no longer mandated to do so, have at their own expense continued in treatment long after that obligation had formally expired.
Let's take another. We have two Maggies calling. Let me get to Maggie in South Jordan. Maggie, welcome.
Hi. I have a question specifically related to the nature that goes into the abuse. And it just sounds a little bit like the behavior is excused in that these children are tricked and are in some cases threatened and in other ways have terrible things said or done to them to keep them quiet. And how is that duplicitous nature fixed enough to send the adults back into society so they don't find another child that they may like a lot or be attracted to?
Hmm.
Well, I think that's a fair point, but I'd also mention that the people you're using here as examples, the ones that are threatening, the ones that are willing to scare a child, that then does get into something else besides a pedophilic orientation. That begins to say something about the selfishness of the individual or about their characterological makeup. So those people would indeed be more difficult to to deal with. But the fact of the matter is that most of the people, certainly that I've seen over the years, and I've seen well over a couple of hundred, were as much into deceiving themselves. They convinced themselves that this child is enjoying the experience, the child likes it, and I like it. And so it's been much more that kind of a self-deceptive process where they haven't really been in touch with the kinds of psychological confusion and so on that their actions can cause, rather than a conscious, malicious disregard for that youngster.
I'm not sure if this is a proper line of questioning, but the question did come up to me, the question of rape, for example. You often hear that described as an exercise in power and control, that this is not about sex. For a rapist, it's about, you know, it's about violence. Is the mind of a rapist different than from the mind of a pedophile?
Well, again, we have to, it is a bit of a divergence, but let me get into that. Rape is a behavior, and from a psychiatric perspective, we can look at it from three points of view. One is the behavior itself, which by definition is always coercive, one person forcing another into unwanted activity. The second way we can look at it is from the perception of the victim, a very important perception, and from that perception, it's always viewed as a hostile and violent and unwanted experience. But in knowing the behavior and in knowing the consequence, do we necessarily know anything about what motivated the individual to engage in that behavior in the first place? And the answer is no. There are many possibilities. Sometimes rape is just enacted by a person who lacks a sense of conscience and moral responsibility and doesn't care if he hurts someone else just so he can get his needs satisfied. There are a group of people, however, who are often serial rapists who are not very aroused sexually by consenting behavior and are recurrently aroused by forcing or coercing another individual into sexual activity. And it doesn't take a mental health expert to appreciate how dangerous an individual can be if he's not sexually aroused by consent and is very turned on by coercion. And many serial rapists who don't engage in other kinds of crimes but who repeatedly have engaged in rape are often driven by abnormal sexual cravings, and it's another area of research that we're trying to learn more about, again, with the idea of hopefully figuring out how to prevent these kinds of horrible crimes and from helping not to have people victimized in these horrible ways.
Dr. Fred Berlin is with us. He's an associate professor of psychology at Johns Hopkins University, also the founder and director of the Johns Hopkins Sexual Disorders Clinic. He's joining us today from a studio at the Baltimore Sun in Baltimore, Maryland. Maggie, thanks for the call. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Dr. Fred Berlin. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Sexual Disorders Clinic. He's helping us understand the nature of pedophilia today. So, Dr. Berlin, there's an important question here. Are those who have pedophilia deserving of treatment? You say that's an important one.
Well, I think that's what we have to think about. You know, it is a very serious matter to take a human life and to consider it to be disposable. And, you know, if we need to sometimes lock people up indefinitely because we have no choice, then we may need to do that. But it is a very serious decision. So in working in this area, you know, I think a lot about what values I want to instill in my own children. They're young adults now, so I've tried to do that in their formative years. And, you know, I absolutely want to be concerned about the safety of my children, but I don't want to be so concerned that if I am sure they're going to be okay, that I then don't want to continue to go out and think about the well-being of so many else's children. And one of the things I've learned in working over the years that we don't hear about in the media is how many letters and calls I get from mothers and fathers, from aunts and uncles, from friends and relatives who know the individual as a human being and who are hoping that some way can be found, not with disregard for protecting others, that always has to be the priority, but within the context of protecting others to see if this life can still be salvaged. So As I've said many times, we have to make sure that people with pedophilia behave responsibly. We have to give them access to treatment if they need it so that they can honor the responsibility of getting the help that is necessary. But we as a society also have a responsibility to think this through. And the easiest thing in the world is to just get angry and say, you know, we don't want to know anything more about these people and just let's lock them up forever. But and we can do that. But I would encourage people to recognize what a serious decision that is, to ask what impact that has on our values as a society. And if there's one message I want people to have here, it's that this isn't a closed book, that the emotion is fully understandable, including the anger and outrage. But there are some things to think about and some things to have a dialogue about. And if we can at least begin to do that, perhaps we can move in the direction of better safeguarding the community and at the same time salvaging the lives of some people who have psychiatric disorders that they themselves would never wanted to have had in the first place.
You make note of a Supreme Court case, Kansas versus Crane, where the court upheld this law that committed some people who had pedophilia, even after they had served out their prison sentences. And the court said, I guess in some ways what they were saying was that this was okay, this was acceptable to do this, to commit these people, because they lacked the ability to control their behavior. So that raises the question, can a person with pedophilia be reasonably expected to control those urges?
Yeah, let me answer that in two ways. First of all, I do think that decision demonstrates how our society hasn't yet made up its mind whether these people are bad or whether they're mentally ill. For example, when the person is first arrested and comes into court, usually if they'll argue, I have a sexual disorder, I need help, I wasn't able to control myself, the attitude is often, you know, who are you kidding, and we're just going to get you off to prison where you belong. 20 years later, that same person, presumably having served their time and paid their debt to society, is now told, oh, no, we got it wrong. It's not that you were just a bad guy misbehaving. You have a sexual disorder. Unless we get you the proper treatment, you're not going to be able to control it, and therefore we're still going to deprive you of your liberty in order to provide you with that care. So I think, again, society hasn't made up its mind whether these people are bad or ill. The other thing I worry about as a psychiatrist is that if they indeed do have an illness and we are keeping them after they've served their time, then I do think as a society we have a responsibility to try to treat them and enable them to eventually re-enter society as safe and productive citizens. And the worry in the many states that are now doing this is that most of these people are being civilly committed after having fully served their prison sentences are not being released. And so it begs the question, is this just a pretext using psychiatry and mental health as a way of giving people that hadn't been given life sentences in the first place a life sentence? If that's what's actually going on, I think it's a terrible misuse of my profession, and I would want to speak out against that, even though every one of us absolutely wants to do whatever we need to do within the context of being a just and safe society to protect innocent people from becoming victimized.
Here's an email from Jen, who writes, if you accept that pedophilia is a mental illness rather than a sexual preference, how do you reconcile treatments with trying to treat other sexual preferences which are seen as more socially acceptable? In other words, if you can treat pedophilia, do you believe you can also treat homosexuality or bisexuality?
Well, first of all, the word preference is tricky, because most of the men that I've met who have pedophilia don't prefer being that way. If they could somehow go in and whatever changes need to be made in the brain, make it, most of them, for reasons I think aren't hard to understand, would much prefer to be like the rest of us. In terms of treatment, though, you know, many of us are fortunate. I'm a heterosexual man, and so nobody's going to say to me, I have to go through life never being intimate with the kind of partner that I am attracted to. But if I'm someone who's unfortunate enough to have the exclusive form of pedophilia, I'm only attracted to children and to nobody else, then I'm going to have to either lead an entirely celibate life or if I'm not, to run the risk of hurting others and going to prison. So that's a tremendous challenge. Now, who should we treat? Listen, we can't get away from this being tied to value judgments. You know, if I have a man who's homosexual but for religious reasons doesn't want to be that way, and wants my help in seeing if he can figure out how to resist those temptations, how to lead a different kind of a lifestyle. If that's what he wants me to try to help him with, I'm going to make it clear that that's not easy. It would be like me, who's heterosexual, deciding not to ever give in to those feelings. But I'll respect his religious beliefs and try to assist him. On the other hand, if he's someone, and we have a diverse society, who is just feeling stigmatized because he's attracted to members of the same gender, is in a loving and caring relationship, then I might approach it very differently. So when it comes to consenting behaviors between adults that are done in privacy, we have a diverse society and we're going to have different opinions about what should or shouldn't be allowed. But when it comes to adults being involved with children, I think we all have to agree that children need to be protected. And therefore, if a person's unlucky enough to have a disorder that draws him sexually towards children, we're going to have to help that person figure out how not to act on those attractions. And fortunately, there are things we can do, including the use of medication, to dramatically lower the intensity of sexual drive to facilitate that person's ability to maintain proper self-control.
Let's go back to the phones. Ryan is joining us in Salt Lake City. Ryan, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Doug and Fred. You've been speaking to the criminalization of those with pedophilia, and I just wondered if you have looked at the consequences of the sex offender registry, both if it has a benefit for children and its disadvantage or demoralization to pedophilic individuals.
Yes, there's a lot of research going into that now. And, it's very hard once something gets on the book to change it. People, sort of feel better because they know there's a registry out there. But it's become so diluted that it's often difficult to see how it's helping. We now have children on the registry. I mean, I've seen examples, and these are real examples, of a young man who, when he was 12 years old, got involved with a 7-year-old child, and he was prosecuted as a delinquent, and that may have been useful in getting him some treatment, but he's now, for the rest of his life, going to be in a sex offender registry. If he wants to go to college, or, well, more likely law school or medical school, he could be held back for something he did when he was simply a child. There are numbers of children, adolescents on there. Well, I shouldn't say children, but adolescents. So, for example, the 17-year-old who was involved with the 15-year-old. Some of them are on sex offender registries. We have people on sex offender registries, again, adolescents. The 17-year-old girl who sent a nude picture of herself to her 18-year-old boyfriend, and technically, because she's not 18, she's producing and distributing child pornography. So, I think what we're going to need to do is kind of step back. We years ago, when I was a young man, had situations where an ounce of marijuana could get somebody into prison for 30 or 40 years, and we began to realize, look, there are discriminations we need to make. There is proportionality that we need to make. Right now, we've got large numbers of people on sex offender registry. Some of them, we may be better off having them there. We certainly want the police and authorities to be able to track them. But there are large numbers of people whose lives we may simply be ruining, with it serving no useful purpose in terms of protecting the larger society.
Ryan, thanks. And we had a call earlier from a John. That wasn't his name, actually. He called himself John. He hung up, but I wanted to ask the question that he had posed anyway. John said he had been in prison for pedophilia, and he mentioned the fact that the focus in terms of treatment, as I understand it, was on punishment, not on prevention. And he wonders if there would have been more of a focus on the idea of prevention as opposed to the punitive part of it, the punishment part, if that could have, in fact, as he put it, saved him from assaulting a child.
Well, I don't want to address his situation. I don't know anything about him, obviously. But there, it is important, first of all, when treating pedophilia, to recognize that there's a tremendous responsibility to community safety. That also always has to come first in my judgment. At the same time, you also have to have a genuine concern for the human being that you are treating. And if that person gets the sense that all you're doing is protecting society, you don't care about them as an individual, it seems to me that common sense alone would suggest that that's going to undermine the development of any kind of a proper therapeutic relationship. And so there are some programs, and I think this is unfortunate, where the only sense that the program has is we're protecting society from these people, and we have to tolerate them as part of doing so. I don't think that works. I think the what John said, the perception that people don't really care about my best interests is going to get in the way. So let me underline that the first priority has to be to protect society. But within the context of that, if we don't give these folks a sense that we care about them, we appreciate their struggles, some of them are depressed or potentially suicidal, then as of speaking now as a physician and as a psychiatrist, we're not doing the proper kind of treatment for these folks. And again, if we fail to help them, not only is it bad for them, but it can be bad for the larger community as well.
Time for one more call. Bill is with us in Blackfoot, Idaho. Bill, we don't have a lot of time, but welcome.
Yeah, I'll just address it real quickly. This is for the doctor. I was just concerned about the rise of internet porn. And basically, if you've been aware of a rise in pedophilia as a result of the access to this type of material where normally you would have only been able to go to like an adult bookstore,
yeah.
But now it's... I mean, it's right there at the click of a finger.
Right. The effect of the internet, Fred Berlin?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's tremendous problems. The internet's like atomic energy. You can light the world or blow up the world. There are people now, and certainly we need to protect children from being exploited in the production of child pornography. Nobody can disagree about that. We are finding, though, that there are some people who have a voyeuristic interest in looking at child pornography, but there's no evidence that they are actually interested in being with a child sexually. They get arrested, their computers are confiscated, they're not on chat rooms looking for kids, they have their own children, the children indicate they've never been exploited, their name gets in the paper, nobody else comes forward. So again, in terms of proportionality, we want to make sure that we are, if these are people who are looking at pictures, punishing them or dealing with them, even treating them for what the problem actually is, which is their voyeuristic interest in seeing this imagery, and not necessarily assume they're synonymous with someone who might be more of a risk to a child because their interests go beyond simply looking at photographs.
Bill, thanks very much. Dr. Fred Berlin, he's an associate professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University, the founder of the Johns Hopkins Sexual Disorders Clinic, joined us today from a studio in Baltimore. Dr. Berlin, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Matthew Martin. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.